Time reveals ethics. And I'm so glad that those of you here allowed me to play with you today. This is Earthwatch here on the air. 212-209-2900 is the phone number. That's that racist who makes fun of Indians. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
I am, you know, I'm frenetic and I'm serene. I'm outraged at how subverters and FBIers are trying to take over the station, yet I'm so proud of what we're doing.
Let me give you two quick kudos, and then I'll tell you why I called. One kudo was for how you guys handled the day of the flood and earthquake when you sent it out to California.
Oh, you heard that?
Oh, honey, it was so good. There ought to have been a law. It could have been cheesecake. It was so good. Okay.
I'm in love with you already.
Oh, thank you, sweetheart. And the second was the coverage that you did today. God bless and may the universe love you.
I'm already feeling that. On behalf of all of us here, including my disputees, my friends, lovers, colleagues, enemies, and collaborators, BAI is that mix because it is alive.
And, you know, I just wanted to say one thing. I thought about what was an appropriate song, and I said Nina Simone did, except she used Mississippi. Yeah.
God damn.
Yeah.
My girl, you know what I'm talking about.
I love her. I used to
watch. There are some who think they're beyond that.
Oh, please, never. Okay, the other thing was, I was lying here, and I purposely ran an errand tonight so that I wouldn't be here for the fallout, you know, be home. Which it was the 7 o'clock.
You know, I kept my attention on it throughout the evening, and I socialized, and I educated with people who didn't know, and I did a running cavalcade at various social events this evening.
I did something because I said I couldn't be home. And then when I was...
instead of just sitting around here.
Yeah, I couldn't sit home because I couldn't take it, you know, because I went through King, Malcolm, Mecca Evers, Viola Liuzzo, that whole, the little four girls in Mississippi. I couldn't take any more, you know, right now because I've got my own problems. But what I wanted to say was, I said, what about this thing doesn't make sense? It's not just that the man is innocent. There's more going on here than it seems.
Let that be an example to you. I got to leave it there because we only got 2 minutes.
Okay, let me say this quickly.
Yeah.
We was hoodwinked, okay?
Bamboozled.
They never expected to do it at 7. They wanted to wait for everybody to get out and go home and be happy, and they knew what they were going
to
do.
They wanted our blood to be like ketchup with Antissa.
Yeah.
Patient.
They knew what they wanted to do.
Yeah, you see, there's a word for that, but I'm not going to say it on the air. This is Earthwatch. Thank you, my sister. Everybody's got about 15 seconds. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. New York City cab driver. I'm really sad about what happened tonight. I have a Troy Anthony Davis button in his memory.
Good for you, man.
Yeah. I was not expecting to pick up a button in St. Mary's Church, only to see hours later that this innocent brother, man, or a father, uncle, cousin, you know, it could have been to all of us, you know, because I'm Puerto Rican, you know, that could have been my family.
Yeah, and you know what's beautiful? I think Troy is thanking us for being brave. This is Earth Welch, you're on the air. You know, only a white man of privilege could so disrespect the indigenous culture of this continent with his tired old shtick. This is Earthwatch. You know, I'm not going to let him be on this air because this is a sacred place. Quick. You're on the air.
WBS?
Yeah, hey.
Hey, how are you? I want to your program was great tonight.
Thank you.
And I hope, you know, it's a wake-up call for a lot of minorities to get educated and lead some progress.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Become a little more involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, white is another word for later on. You know what I mean? Thank you, brother. All right, I got to get out of here. Oh, my God, it's already technically time. And here comes Jim Freund. And at a beautiful moment in a tragic incident in American history, Jim Freund tells me that he's coming in prepared to do some free effing forum radio. And I could have no greater pleasure on my way home. So
That may mean... totally withdrawing and playing a recording. I mean, I don't know.
Well, that's free form.
Well, it is.
It's
the point
your
is
choice,
that
baby.
Here it is, 30 mm-hmm. seconds in.
Yeah.
And I...
Ow!
I don't have a plan.
Well, you have the con, Jim. It's dead, Jim.
I do. Where is it? Wait a second. Oh, I see a con artist.
This is one of the... souls that inspired me about B.A. Jim
Freund.
You
always say that.
Yeah. It's a safe lie.
It always freaks me out.
No, it's true.
It really was Neil Adams.
Well, it was his artwork, but you presented it.
Yeah. You know, I have been...
Anybody who doesn't read comics and these Marvel and DC crossovers, that has nothing to do with
you are going to be
sequential
through
arts.
The month of October, the entire freaking Marvel bullpen.
Homer Simpson.
November 10th is Danny Fingeroth. Chris Claremont.
Tim, I remember. Was he with Spider-Man at one point?
No, that was Danny Fingeroth.
Chris
is X-Men.
That's why I remember. I know the name.
Chris is X-Men. Mm. I mean, also Sovereign 7 and about 40 other headphones. I don't use headphones.
Headphones.
Yeah, speak into the headphones. Louise Simonson, a.k.a. Wheezy Simonson, and her husband, Walt Simonson. So, Jim. We're talking Batman and Superman
let me tell you
there.
The truth. Okay.
Okay, but if you're going to do that, let me put on a mic. Okay.
I was just some stupid guy who thought he was smart doing new things in BAI way back in the pre-egg virgin days of my nascence here.
Okay.
And
you know,
there was one day that this guy, who I once saw picking up a premium of a beautiful Broadway poster of Neil Adams, said, after Paul Wonder cussed me out for dropping an unreeled... air check on the reel-to-reel. And, you know, we used to keep them on the hubs. And I messed that up one day. And Paul Wonder pretended to let me think that I could somehow put it back together.
Right.
He was a cruel MF. But I loved him. Oh, you think? And we all love Paul. And it was during that epoch that you did a... thing that destroyed my soul. You invited me to a comic book convention that was up the block from 35th Street up to 44th Street at 8th Avenue.
I believe that was a science fiction convention,
not
a comic book.
My bad.
Well, because comic book conventions are commercial.
I had so much sex and evil that day that I don't even remember why.
Science fiction conventions are non-commercial. There's a big, big difference.
Part, which means either nothing, half, or all is true.
There you go.
Well, God bless.
Zygazant.
Set your sights at thunder and steer towards the star.
Okay.
No, I prefer it the way I say it.
Yeah, is that second star to the right and keep on till morning? It's something like that. Well, be may that it as is. I guess it's time to howl.
It's a mystical moment. Sydney is here. Your guest is here. I'm gone. I'm Robert.
She's my off-air guest.
Jim Freund. Oh.
She's my guest from Science Fiction Fandom. She's a friend from about that era. About that era of New York science fiction fans. Mm. And... And but yeah, see, I had that mic up, Sydney, before you started manhandling the microphone. What the heck is going on with this stupid computer here? I hope you all realize that this is about as professional as we get in radio here at WBAI in New York City. Listener sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. I'm going to start my theme music 5 minutes late. I cannot look at the TV. And I mean, this is one of the few times in which the TV represents a reality that I don't want to cope with. I would rather escape. And I know people accuse science fiction too often of being an escape, but well, I'm just unbelieving of the news. That is often my state of affairs. I have a very simple method of dealing with things. I try to ignore them, put my fingers in my ears, make noises, and hope it will all go away, and that I'll wake up on a planet where the kind of rubbish that we've had to deal with today doesn't occur. So let's howl. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, we have... I don't know what we have. Stay tuned. Thank you. And good morning. Okay, I mean, the truth is, no, I'm not necessarily going to be dealing with current affairs. Had they gone the way that I thought they would go, there would have been really no need to do it. Since they went tragically, I would have loved to have broadcast a short story that the author, I think, believes is better buried, a story called Max, M-A-C-S, by Terry Bisson, B-I-S-S-O-N. He's this wonderful short story writer who has a very, very cutting, satiric edge when he wants. And, I mean, some of the stuff he writes is merely good science fiction. And he writes essays here and there. But occasionally he writes political satire, almost of the Swiftian variety. I mean, really cutting, nasty, nasty stuff. And this story was one of his most brilliantly nastiest. And you can't even really talk about the story without leading people toward the spoiler. I mean, it's a very, very short story. It's under 2,000 words, as I recall. And some of his better pieces, like this one piece, they're made out of meat, which for which he's probably best remembered. Makes Robert giggle anyway. Is a very, very short piece. And so there are a few ways I can go. One possibility is, I'm very upset also, is that I had a couple of interviews that I would have been ready to put on the air, and in searching earlier today, they weren't where I thought they were. This is something I'm going to have to deal with. And if you happen to be a Strawn, then you know who I'm talking about. Karen, I'll have to talk to you about how we're going to figure that out. Maybe I'll have her live on the air. It'll be mid-afternoon in Australia where she is, so no problem for her. At any rate, and I almost talked Andy Duncan into being here tonight after his reading of KGB Fantastic Fiction series, but I made a major mistake. I gave him a livable option, and the option being that if I simply played the reading that he did tonight and broadcast that, then I would allow him to be the guest over the phone instead of live in the studio. And given that he wants to get home, which is DC-ish, in the morning, he opted for the easy way out. I shouldn't have given him the choice. He's a wonderful writer, excellent reader. Both readers at KGB, well, Swanwick, you know, Swanwick is always going to be good. It's taken for granted. But that's because we get to see him here a lot. Never let it be forgotten how brilliant and wonderful a reader Andy Duncan is. It was a brilliant double feature. Biting, funny, Swanwick story, as depressing as Michael's stuff always gets at the end, although it was a bittersweet end. Very nice. It reminded me just slightly of Frederick Pohl's Gateway, not in the story itself, but in the sort of like apocalyptic, oh, but the couple are happy. Kind of thing. But Michael does a lot of this catch-in-your-throat sentiment, humorous sentiment. Really, he does it so well. Anyway, my reading series is good, too. That's the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, which it's not too early to start promoting our next reading. So I will do that right now. October 4th, Tuesday, October 4th. We'll have a lot of people in town because October 3rd is the Science Fiction Writers of America, what they call the Mill and Swill. Once a year, SFWA holds a party for just industry people, agents, publishers, and all that. And they're doing, I shouldn't give out the location and everything. That would be a bit too much. But it's on Times Square, let's put it that way, in an expensive joint. For the third year, and probably the last year, I think they're going to be holding it there. But anyway, so we're going to have all these people in town October 3rd. October 4th. So that just tells you who's going to be in the audience. October 4th, we've got Susan and Clay Griffith, who are writers of not just vampire fiction, it's steampunk vampire fiction. Their first novel, The Grey Friar. God, no, that's not a chicken. It's a 19th century thing. Got huge acclaim and stuff and became a cult item very, very quickly. And the second novel in their series, Rift Walker, is just out. This is the series is called The Vampire Empire. And we did a vampire thing last year with Linda Addison and Terrence Taylor, who actually produced the event, Alaya Dawn Johnson, and L.A. Banks, who just died a couple of months ago at 51 years old of cervical cancer. Just really horrid story. And she was writing bestsellers. She was churning out from Philadelphia, this urban. These are all black vampire writers. Terrence called it Beyond Blackula. And it was a great event. We're going to do something else that will be of similar urban writing within the genres. But so we're going to keep the vampire theme this year, but with Susan and Clay Griffith, who were like guests of honor at Dragon Con. I mean, they're a big deal. This is really cool. But our second person won't be a writer. More is the pity. Because when Margot Adler attended the Clarion Science Fiction Writers Workshop in 1973, she gave up doing her show called Hour of the Wolf. And I took it over. And I'm not giving it back. Unless, of course, she asks, in which case it's like, well, sure. But I mean, she has this All Things Considered thing that she does and this other thing called Morning Edition. You know, she's an award-winning reporter, National Public Radio. Let her slum. She has two books out, Drawing Down the Moon, which is probably the definitive book on neo-paganism, and Heretic's Heart, which is about her radical Berkeley days and stuff like that. And Adler, the reason why she is so appropriate, aside from the fact that I will take any excuse to put her on a podium where I will have her, whether she's doing stuff or not. She's sort of like, since I knew her and we met in about, 1971, she's been sort of my role model for 40 years. Adler recently got a fetish about vampires, or not a fetish, an obsession. That's a better word. She has to date, according to an email she sent me yesterday. I sent a bio off to get the authors to agree. And I said she's read 150 vampire novels in a row. And she wrote me back that the correction to her bio is 184. We're not saying they're good, but we're saying that they're fascinating. There's a connection, and there will be a professional connection, although I'll let her announce that at the reading. But suffice it to say that there is, Margot has at least once lectured on vampire fiction and why it is so pervasively popular and what it means to society and to individuals, and she will do that again. So she's going to host the evening and give us a lecture about vampire fiction, following which Susan and Clay Griffith will read. So that's Tuesday, October 4th at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art. 138 Sullivan Street. Admission is free. If you would like more information written through email or such purposes, send me a note to jim@ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF.com, and I will put you on me personal, never to be shared with anybody, mailing list, in which the only thing I do is I send out about 2 emails a month promoting that event. The other thing you can do is join a listserv called Gotham Lit. That Eugene Myers puts out. Even though he left New York, he maintains this mailing list of events that occur within New York, which include the KGB Fantastic Fiction, my series, and a few other things. But don't you want to direct from me? Anyway. So that's what we got coming up in October. November, by the way, is a tribute to Murray Leinster with... Murray Leinster was a pseudonym for Will Jenkins, with his daughter, Billy Stallings, who has a book out about Will Jenkins, and people who, well, either knew him or could analyze him, his writing, that is, and that will include Michael Swanwick and Barry N. Malzberg, and more to be a player to be named later. December will be Kushner and Sherman. That's Ellen Kushner and Delia Sherman, because December is a family month. You know, you turn on the TV and you see all these families of all the people and all that. And so we get to do a family, and mine are Ellen Kushner and Delia Sherman, because they were married before it was legal in New York, in Massachusetts. And I think before that they were married in Toronto. I think they should get married in New York now. I think they should go around the country and get married in every place where same-sex marriage is allowed, because they can. But, I mean, that would mean they would have to take up residence there, and I don't want them leaving New York. But I think they should have a New York wedding. I think they should do it at one of our readings. We can have Margot perform the ceremony. Ooh, this is shaping up. Anyway. I'm off my rocker. Okay, so what will we do this morning? Well, we could just take phone calls. I could play an interview. I could play some radio drama, old or new. I could play half of last week's New York Review of Science Fiction reading. I don't have time for both, but I could play, I think, the Chris Claremont reading. We're going to have a lot of Marvel on the air, as I was telling Robert earlier, because at that reading, I met Wheezy Simonson, a.k.a. Louise Simonson, and her husband, Walt Simonson. These are, you know, huge, huge names in the comics book industry. And I met there Danny Fingeroth, who, you know, did a thing for a few years called Spider-Man that maybe you've heard of. He also has a book coming out about Stan Lee in October. And, I mean, these are just names that, you know, there's only one typeface that you can imagine for those names, because it was that, you know, what they call comic book sans serif that you find in all your computers. And you see all those names in that typeface. I know now I should have used that font for my last reading. Anyway, all these people, I was talking to them, the loveliest people in the world, all these people are going to be guests on Hour of the Wolf sometime in the next couple of months. Even though I'm no expert on comics, I'll see if I can get Ken Gale to sit on some of these shows. So, we could play Chris Claremont's reading. A few weeks ago, I read a Heinlein story entitled All You Zombies. And there's another classic Heinlein story called By His Bootstraps that was turned into a fabulous radio drama on the West Coast. Let me see here. Just how long does that whole thing run? Oh, it's in a matter of tracks. Well, it's under... We may not even have time for that right now. And also, I haven't reacquired the rights to play this other thing. So, no, I'm not going to do that. But it's a reading, a dramatic reading by Richard Dreyfuss. And it's really good. And didn't Richard Dreyfuss's name come up at the reading tonight? Yeah, yeah. Andy Duncan said his piece somewhere in the 70s. And so one of the characters was asking the other, oh, do you know about this Richard Dreyfuss guy? Well, anyway. That's for a future morning. Or, so I'm willing to take phone calls. Oh, yes, here's another good possibility. A few months, every year, we do a tribute to a person, like we're going to be doing one for Murray Leinster, who's, by the way, turns out, and I never knew this, that his name was Leinster. Never mind the fact that his name was Jenkins. But apparently, Leinster, the German in me says this would be Leinster, right? But no, it's actually British. Leinster County, according to Billy Stallings, and Will Jenkins, who took the name, pronounced it Leinster. Never knew. Never knew the guy's pseudonym was Murray Leinster, not Murray Leinster. You want one Murray Leinster title? Time Tunnel. Ah! Got you there. You knew that one. I mean, you knew that story if you didn't know who Murray Leinster was. You all know that. The Wailing Asteroid. Eh, if you read science fiction, you know that one. But everybody knows Time Tunnel. Come on. It was, you know, enforced reading, you know, the Scholastic book edition, you know, that had about three sentences from the original. But earlier this year, we did a Theodore Sturgeon tribute with Noelle Sturgeon, Sturgeon's daughter. I've been in touch with all these daughters. I've met and know Robert Sheckley's daughter. I've spoken to two women named Linebarger about the works of Cord Wainer Smith. I read the name of The Game of Rat and Dragon recently on the air, so you should know Cord Wainer Smith's work. And this was Noelle Sturgeon. And we had two readers for the Sturgeon event. One was Samuel R. Delaney, and the other was Nora K. Jemison, N.K. Jemison. And the Jemison, the one that she read, Bianca's Hands, ooh, that's good for this hour because it's really creepy. And then there was, and then Noelle, who teaches, she's a professor. So she knows how to work a crowd. She did a Q&A with Delaney and Nora and herself on Sturgeon's writing. So these are all the things that we could have this morning, or we could just take phone calls. What I'm going to do now is take phone calls about which we should do. I will let you not vote. There's no democracy now. There's rather... you can try to influence me. And the way you can do that is by calling WBAI at 212-209-2900, and I will take your calls. Anybody who's just like sitting back in the studio, if you want to hear the calls, you have to wear headphones. Otherwise, you won't hear the calls. 212-209-2900. I will urge you, however, to go and listen, try to read. I don't know why Terry took that story off the market. There was a point at which he did not want Max read, but I thought it was such a brilliant story and all that. I would, if I had the recording with me, I would defy him and play it, but I will write him and ask him what he thinks of that. Okay. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning.
Good morning.
If you're not going to take phone calls, it would be lovely to hear Bianca's Hands.
Okay.
That's it?
Yeah. Very good. Okay. And how about you? You're on the air.
Hello.
Good morning. You're on the air.
How are you?
Okay.
I got something to say. Let's see. Joseph Hurley, of all people, and my friend, said X-Men First Class was like really like one of the greatest superhero movies ever made, and I heard all these rave things about it. I thought it was really bad.
I'm sorry, but I agree with you.
You know, and it's like, here's another thing. The complete Freudian thing, you don't even, you know how George Carlin said, you don't have to be Freud to get the implications of this. when you're pulling a submarine underwater, you're going to sink, right?
Well, you know,
I think Chuck Berry wrote a song about that, right?
Well, as off topic as you are,
like,
I'm going to entertain your call.
No, I'm not watching this scene. And then, like, Xavier with hair and can walk, which I think...
How does James McAvoy turn into Patrick Stewart?
I didn't even know who these characters were. And it's like, I didn't even know who these actors were. And I'm like, why do I care? And
well,
it's
James...
And it's like, you know, I have the Thor movie here, too, and I haven't even watched it, like, dreading it, thinking, like, you know who's the director? I'm spacing
on... Kenneth Branagh.
Yeah, the same director who did that horrible Frankenstein with, Robert De Niro.
Yeah, that was pretty bad.
Flouncy.
Yeah,
there's a lot of stuff that's flouncy.
Yeah,
that's
but you have to also acknowledge that.
I went to school with these people.
Hello, dialogue or monologue here?
Well,
okay, one should acknowledge that Kenneth Branagh is one of the greatest living directors, though he made some terrible movies. But Olivier made some really sucky movies also.
Temperamental.
Say again.
It's temperamental.
It's not temperamental.
It's my personal.
It's Hollywood
blah,
machine.
You know, it's like it's very Yang. I don't know. I just don't go for it, I guess.
Okay. And as far as who these actors were, maybe you don't know who James McAvoy is, and Michael Fassbender, but I certainly do, and these are great actors.
Well,
that doesn't mean
like
that these are great movies, but I'm sorry that you don't know them.
Which movie are we talking about now?
You were talking about X-Men,
X-Men
First Class.
I thought you were talking about another movie.
No.
Because I didn't know who these people were, I guess.
Well, but you see, that's, to be polite, that's your problem. These are both great, accomplished actors.
Okay, they're good actors, but
yeah.
If I didn't know who they were, and it's like, and I didn't even know who the characters that they're playing, and it just seems they're trying very hard to do.
Well, I mean,
a comic book movie. And that kind of seems like out of place, I guess. So that's
well, it
why,
does
me,
and
it
doesn't
work.
Because remember that X-Men First Class is the fifth movie in a series.
Yeah, what's the best one, Jim?
The first X-Men.
No, the Wolverine.
Oh.
I said, like, when I first watched the first X-Men movie, I'm thinking like all these characters are horrible. If they just did a movie with just Wolverine, it would be very good. And when I got around to seeing it, that's exactly what I thought.
Well, the problem with the Wolverine movie is that they messed with the character in many ways that didn't follow. They turned the character that was his father into his brother. They made so many contradictions within it. And aside from that, the whole denouement with the woman and all that, it was so predictable. And the whole Marvel angst, I shouldn't say this since we're about to have pretty much the entire Marvel bullpen on this show in the next couple of months, including the people that wrote the original stories in which these movies are based. But the movies are not their fault. They didn't get paid a penny, even though they merely wrote them.
And
created the characters.
Come on, Kevin Bacon is the villain. He's about as threatening as Joni Mitchell. He's also the villain in...
Joni Mitchell can be pretty threatening.
Well, I don't know.
I went
to school with him. I won't say anything more. But he also is the villain in Super with Rainn Wilson, which is also a very bizarre movie with Ellen Page, who's like very talented.
I love Ellen Page.
Did you see it?
No, I did not.
It's very, very, very demented. It's kind of like Kick-Ass meets... I don't know, Captain Nice or something. It's like very, very demented.
I was a bit Captain Nice.
And please don't do this at home, you know? It's like
right.
Nobody can do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you want to see a fun Ellen Page performance? There's a TV series virtually unknown in this country called Regenesis. It's a Canadian TV series. And it's already...
Not like Star Lost?
No.
I was watching UFO and they were smoking cigarettes on
Okay, well, we're talking about a Canadian TV series that's about a bioengineering lab that deals with sort of like the CDC and actually does involve the CDC in certain episodes. And the lead character, played by Peter Outerbridge, who's a fabulous actor, virtually unknown. His daughter is played by Ellen Page. So if you want to see Ellen Page in a weekly ongoing series turning in great performances from 10 years ago when she was really young, watch a series called Regenesis.
I never heard of it.
As I said, nobody has.
Yeah.
But it does air on some really crappy television networks in this country, and it is on in Canada.
I could have sworn we had this bit before where I was trying to ask you about the Scandinavian, I think it was called the Ice Princess, Scandinavian kind of like oh, like early Disney-style animation. It was just like the best animation, and I'm a big fan of animation, like Fleischer and Disney and all that, and this is like probably just as good, if not better.
Mm-hmm.
And I called you in, and I asked you, do you remember talking about it? And you, like, completely didn't.
And I still don't really remember talking about it.
I wonder if anyone else knows. It's called, I think, like, the one movie that I do know is called The Ice Princess, which is a specific, I don't know. It's, like, a very long, like, story.
hold on one second. While we are on the, right now, I will type into the, I will go to imdb.com, mm-hmm. which I'm sure you will agree is pretty definitive.
Well, I don't have a computer.
I do right now.
I know. You're like a Mr. Wizard.
Well, no, it's a computer here. It's what we play music on and everything.
Okay. I'm just so glad I don't have to touch one.
well, you know, you can get them cleaned. But, okay, so I am now going to the Internet Movie Database, which is what IMDb stands for. And under titles, I am going to type in Ice Princess. I'm not a fast typer.
Get a Michelle track.
Dark in here. I'm not even. That's what. Let's see. Yeah, I mean, the first thing is Princess on Ice. Now, here's possibly what you were thinking of. Made for TV is the Ice Princess. This is 1996.
Huh.
Oh, now here's one, 2007, also made for TV, and that's a Swedish... Okay, let's see which one of these is animated.
There's an early one. I'm talking about this is probably the 30s or the 50s or something, like made a long time ago.
Well, it's not listed in the Internet Movie Database.
Well,
So not only don't I remember it, but neither does... The IMDb.
I think it was like Channel 21 that were playing them.
Well, whatever, but it's not listed as a movie.
Well, there's like a holiday that it reflects, so then it's also like an opera, I think, too. But
Wait. There is Duprice, De Princess, 1934, all the way on the bottom. But it's live action.
Huh. Well, there was a series of these movies that I was certain that you were, like, talking about. So I was just like, wow, that was really amazing. Because I saw, I guess, like, a glimpse of it, like, the last, like, I don't know, 15 minutes of like, one of them. And I thought, like, this is a really amazing animation. It's, like, better than anything I've seen Disney do.
Well, that was in my other life, I'm afraid. Because I don't remember it. And neither does the IMDb.
Sort of, like, time slip or something like that, right?
Or it has a different title.
When people think, like, Mandela got... there's another... universe where there were certain Nelson Mandela, God forbidden, had been killed or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Anyhow, I should move along because I was going to only ask people what I'm going to do this morning.
Well, carry on. I have a suggestion, though.
Yeah.
Since they truncated Mr. Max Schmid's show where he did horror and science fiction, it's like maybe you could play like a segment of, I don't know. I love those H.P. Lovecraft radio adaptions.
Well, I don't have them with me.
No, I mean, if it's possible to do so in the future, if you could play like little snippets like that, like you used to do, I guess, in your old.
Well, yes, and I have been doing the last few weeks, but we're moving up to overbooked. I'm going from 0 to 60, where every week has a different plan coming up. And I don't even know when the next fundraising drive begins. I'm afraid to book people and then find out, oh, you can't be on. We're raising money that
night. Okay, we agree the X-Men movie was bad.
X-Men First Class. I will tell you that I had a screener copy, and I've not gotten past the first half hour. So I wouldn't say it was bad. I would say it was boring. I didn't.
Yeah, it's very, you know, and it's trying to be like something like, it seemed like an episode of Heroes would have been better, I guess. But I haven't seen the Thor movie.
But Heroes isn't even that good.
They kind of, you know, they said.
They started good.
To be continued and then, like, canceled the series. It's like, isn't there, like, something else that was.
But you know, something that Heroes and the first X-Men film have in common is same producer. But then he left Heroes and he left.
And the other bad
X-Men
movie
as well.
Was IM4, which was like just like watching Smallville, and then I saw it was like the same producer too. So
yeah,
but it was really bad. It was like
yeah, no, nobody really liked that. Although you know, I had hopes for Marty Knoxon because she did a very good job on Buffy.
Eh, You know, it's like if something is bad when it's so bad you can't even goof on it. You know, you can't even have a Mystery Science Theater, like, kind of moment with it. It's just kind of, like, so bad. Anyway.
Anyhow, that was a movie purposely targeted at, you know, 13-year-old youngsters and lady youngsters. You know, it's going for the Twilight crowd. If you didn't, and if you love Twilight, you probably will love I Am Number 4.
You know, I have to admit, even though I should hate it, I should have better values in life, I guess, but it's like guilty pleasure. I was watching the Twilight series and thinking, like, it's not so bad. It's horrible, but it's not so bad. You know? It's kind of like, well, okay, all right.
Anyhow, let me move on.
All right.
Take care. Good night. Or good morning. And hi there, you're on the radio. Yellow. No, I didn't press that right. No, or you're gone. Hi there, you are on the air.
Good morning again. I guess you made up your mind, or not?
No.
Oh. Well, just a couple of quickie things. And Terry Bisson. When I think of Terry Bisson, I think of bears and fire.
Okay. But do you realize now that if we talk about this, we will have by default made a decision?
Okay, well...
In other words, I'm not yet... I shouldn't have let the other call go on as long. I'm going to take a firmer hand. Now, if we take calls, call back.
Okay.
Okay, very good. Bye-bye. And good morning. You're on the air. Hello.
Hello.
Hi there. How are you?
Oh, hi. Fine. How are you? Yeah, I don't have a specific request, but I really would love for you to read a story or play a story that you've read. I really do miss that, like the other man said, when you used to do that more often.
Yeah, but there's a reason I don't.
Why?
Well, it's one I don't even like to discuss on the air. For me to read stories on the air, I have to have the rights.
You have to have the rights.
Right.
Is that harder to get than it used to be?
Well, let's put it this way. When I used to do it, it was at 5 a.m., and it was transitory, which is to say when the show was over, the show was over.
Yeah.
The broadcast was done.
Oh,
hopefully I sold a few books for the author.
Archives, you mean.
Right.
Oh.
Now, if I do, this very show is going to be available for a long time.
Right.
And anybody can tune in for weeks after it's
brought. How long has that been going on, exactly?
About 4 years.
And so that's around the time you started changing the format a little bit?
Yeah, and I did it unannounced. I never explained.
Right.
Because there is a tacit admission that I wasn't always getting the rights to the stories earlier. And I think most writers knew that. I think most writers were aware, but they also knew that I was working to sell their work.
Right.
I was working to popularize
right.
them. But there are several complications.
And popularize them and their names. People go out and buy other things they bought. They
right.
wrote,
but here's something else to consider.
Yeah.
If I read a story on the air, I could be ruining somebody's chances for a contract with Audible.com.
Yeah.
And 5 years ago, there was no way they were going to sell the audio rights their short work. Today...
So now you read it, and now it can be distributed, and people don't need to buy anything else.
Well, it's not just that. It's that if you... Let's say that you were a producer for... there are about two or three companies that are putting out audio... stories and audiobooks and things like that. Would you buy a story that you knew was circulating already on the internet?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. So you see, I would be helping them sell books. Today, I might be preventing them from selling an audiobook.
Oh, yeah. Now you explained it. That's interesting. I always did wonder.
It really, really, really annoys me because I love reading on
the air.
Yeah,
and you do it so well.
Thank you.
And by the way, somebody once said to you that your voice was somewhat similar to Richard Dreyfuss. I had noticed that myself.
I know. People
say
that.
Which is a great compliment. You know, he won an Oscar. A few, I think.
Well, yeah, and he's a great reader.
He is, yeah. And so are you.
Well, thank you. Yeah, but I think he's a little better. Come on. Richard Dreyfuss, for God's sake. Anything else you'd like to hear this morning?
Nothing specific. I can't think of a specific title. Just any good short story.
Okay, good. So it's tortoise story.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, take care. Okay, you know what, gang? It's going to be the sturgeon. I have decided. Because it hasn't been broadcast yet, because it was recent, because it is Nora Jemison. It's a great story, and there's a possibility of user discussion. I mean, in user discussion? God, I've been with computers too long. Listener discussion afterward. And it's relatively short. So we are going to set the Wayback Machine for May. This is fairly recent, last May, to the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, where our guest curator was Noelle Sturgeon, daughter of Theodore Sturgeon. And let me see. There, we got that up there. And this is the second half. The first half, you're going to say, why isn't he playing the Samuel R. Delaney? And the answer is because it runs long. Fear not. It will be broadcast. I promise you, it will be broadcast. Chip's reading was simply wonderful, but Nora did a great job herself. And this story is a psychologically bizarre story. And Nora, N.K. Jemisin, whose new novel is coming out in a couple of months, she hasn't written anything that hasn't been Hugo Nebula nominated. Because she's really good. And well, you know, one of the rising black writers out there today. Well, you'll hear it and you'll judge.
So I am very, very pleased to introduce N.K. Jemisin, Nora Jemisin, who's an author of speculative fiction, short stories, and novels, and lives and writes in Brooklyn, New York. In addition to writing, she is a counseling psychologist specializing in career counseling, a sometime hiker and biker, and a political feminist anti-racist blogger. Her short fiction has been published in professional markets such as Clark's World, Postscripts, Strange Horizons, and Van's Universe. It also appeared in podcast markets and print anthologies. Several of her short stories have received honorable mentions in various years' bests, and one of her stories has been nominated for Hugo and Nebula. Jemisin's first novel, The 100,000 Kingdoms, has been nominated for this year's Hugo and Nebula Awards. I just read it in the last day or so, and it's a fabulous book. It's really great. I recommend it highly. Very good. But the sequel, The Broken Kingdoms, is out now from Orbit Books, book 3 of the Inheritance Trilogy. The Kingdom of Gods is due out in late 2011. So Nora is going to read a story of Ted's called Bianca's Hands. This story was actually written in 1939, but it wasn't, so it was a very early story, but it wasn't published until 1947. It was turned down by many, many editors. It was one of the few stories. Most of the stories my father wrote were published pretty much as soon as they went out the door. But this story, he couldn't get published. In fact, one editor said that he would never publish a story written by a man who could write this particular story. It appears in volume 1, The Ultimate Egoist, of the complete stories. And after it was published, it won an Argosy magazine prize for $1,000, which was a mainstream publication and Ted's first real money that he ever saw. He was very, very proud of that, especially since Graham Greene came in second. And also, this story beat out one of his mother's short stories. So, and we can, I'm sure you want to talk about this story if you hear it. Nora.
Well, I'm going to try and do this justice. I have a hard act to follow, obviously, but I will just say this is actually my second time reading this story, so we'll see how this goes. Bianca's Hands. Bianca's mother was leading her when Rand saw her first. Bianca was squat and small, with dank hair and rotten teeth. Her mouth was crooked and it drooled. Either she was blind or she just didn't care about bumping into things. It didn't really matter because Bianca was an imbecile. Her hands, they were lovely hands, graceful hands, hands as soft and smooth and white as snowflakes, hands whose color was lightly tinged with pink like the glow of Mars on snow. They lay on the counter side by side, looking at Ran. They lay there half-closed and crouching, each pulsing with a movement like the panting of a field creature, and they looked, not watched. Later, they watched him. Now they looked. They did because Rand felt their united gaze, and his heart beat strongly. Bianca's mother demanded cheese, stridently. Rand brought it to her in his own time while she berated him. She was a bitter woman, as any woman has a right to be who is wife of no man and mother to a monster. Rand gave her the cheese and took her money and never noticed that it was not enough because of Bianca's hands. When Bianca's mother tried to take one of the hands, it scuttled away from the unwanted touch. It did not lift from the counter, but ran on its fingertips to the edge and leaped into a fold of Bianca's dress. The mother took the unresisting elbow and led Bianca out. Rand stayed there at the counter, unmoving, thinking of Bianca's hands. Rand was strong in bronze and not very clever. He had never been taught about beauty and strangeness, but he did not need that teaching. His shoulders were wide and his arms were heavy and thick, but he had great soft eyes and thick lashes. They curtained around his eyes now. He was seeing Bianca's hands again, dreamily. He found it hard to breathe. Harding came back. Harding owned the store. He was a large man whose features barely kept his cheeks apart. He said, "Sweep up, Ran. We're closing early today." Then he went behind the counter, squeezing past Ran. Ran got the broom and swept, slowly. "A woman brought cheese," he said suddenly. "A poor woman, with very old clothes. She was leading a girl. I can't remember what the girl looked like, except... who was she?" "I saw them go out," said Harding. "The woman is Bianca's mother, and the girl is Bianca. I don't know their other name. They don't talk to people much. I wish they wouldn't come in here. Hurry up, Ran." Ran did what was necessary and put away his broom. Before he left, he asked, "Where do they live, Bianca and her mother?" "On the other side. A house on no road, away from people. Good night, Ran." Ran went from the shop directly over to the other side, not waiting for his supper. He found the house easily, for it was indeed away from the road and stood rudely by itself. The townspeople had cauterized the house by wrapping it in empty fields. Harshly, "What do you want?" Bianca's mother asked as she opened the door. "May I come in? What do you want? May I come in?" he asked again. She made as if to slam the door and then stood aside. "Come." Ran went in and stood still. Bianca's mother crossed the room and sat under an old lamp in the shadow. Ran sat opposite her on a three-legged stool. Bianca was not in the room. The woman tried to speak, but embarrassment clutched at her voice. She withdrew into the bitterness, saying nothing. She kept peeping at Ran, who sat quietly with his arms folded and the uncertain light in his eyes. He knew she would speak soon, but he could wait. Well, she was silent after that for a time, but now she had given him his intrusion. Then, "It's a great while since anyone came to see me. A great while. It was different before. I was a pretty girl." She bit her words off, and her face popped out of the shadows, shriveled and sagging as she leaned forward. Ran saw that she was beaten and cowed and did not want to be laughed at. "Yes," he said gently. She sighed and leaned back so that her face disappeared again. She said nothing for a moment, sitting looking at Ran, liking him. "We were happy, the two of us," she mused, "until Bianca came. He didn't like her, poor thing. He didn't, no more than I do now. He went away. I stayed by her because I was her mother. I'd go away myself, I would, but people know me, and I haven't a penny, not a penny. They'd bring me back to her, they would, to care for her. It doesn't matter much now, though, because people don't want me anymore, and now they want her, any more than they want her. They don't." Ran shifted his feet uneasily because the woman was crying. "Have you room for me here?" he asked. Her head crept out into the light. Ran said swiftly, "I'll give you money each week, and I'll bring my own bed and things." He was afraid she would refuse. She merged with the shadows again. "If you like," she said, trembling at her good fortune. "Though why you'd want to... still, I guess if I had a little something to cook up nice and a good reason for it, I could make someone real cozy here, but why?" She rose. Ran crossed the room and pushed her back into the chair. He stood over her tall. "I never want you to ask me that," he said, speaking very slowly. "Here?" She swallowed and nodded. "I'll come back tomorrow with the bed and things," he said. He left her there under the lamp, blinking out of the dimness, folded round and about with her misery and her wonder. People talked about it. People said, Ran has moved into the house of Bianca's mother. It must be because... Aha, said some. Ran was always a strange boy. It must be because... Oh, no, cried others, appalled. Ran is such a good boy. He wouldn't... Harding was told. He frightened the busy little woman who told him. He said, Ran is very quiet, but he is honest and does his work. As long as he comes here in the morning and earns his wage, he can do what he wants, where he wants, and is not my business to stop him. He said this so very sharply that the little woman dared not say anything more. Ran was very happy living there. Saying little, he began to learn about Bianca's hands. He watched Bianca being fed. Her hands would not feed her, the lovely aristocrats. Beautiful parasites they were, taking their animal life from the heavy squat body that carried them, and giving nothing in return. They would lie one on each side of her plate, pulsing, while Bianca's mother put food into the disinterested, drooling mouth. They were shy, those hands, of Rand's bewitched gaze. Caught out there, naked in the light and open of the tabletop, they would creep to the edge and drop out of sight, all but four rosy fingertips clutching the cloth. They never lifted from a surface. When Bianca walked, her hands did not swing free, but twisted in the fabric of her dress. And when she approached a table or the mantelpiece and stood, her hands would run lightly up and leap, landing together, resting silently, watchfully, with that pulsing peculiar to them. They cared for each other. They would not touch Bianca herself, but each hand groomed the other. It was the only labor to which they would bend themselves. 3 evenings after he came, Ran tried to take one of the hands in his. Bianca was alone in the room, and Ran went to her and sat beside her. She did not move, nor did her hands. They rested on a small table before her, preening themselves. This, then, was when they really began watching him. He felt it right down to the depths of his enchanted heart. The hands kept stroking each other, and yet they knew he was there. They knew of his desire. They stretched themselves before him, archly, languorously, and his blood pounded hot. Before he could stay himself, he reached out and tried to grasp them. He was strong, and his move was sudden and clumsy. One of the hands seemed to disappear, so swiftly did it drop into Bianca's lap. But the other, Rand's thick fingers closed on it and held it captive. It writhed, all but tore itself free. It took no power from the arm on which it lived, for Bianca's arms were flabby and weak. Its strength, like its beauty, was intrinsic, and it was only by shifting his grip to the puffy forearm that Ran succeeded in capturing it. So intent was he on capturing it, on touching it, holding it, that he did not see the other hand leap from the idiot girl's lap, land crouching at the table's edge. It reared back, fingers curling, spider-like, and sprang at him, fastening on his wrist. It clamped down agonizingly, and Ran felt bones give and crackle. With a cry, he released the girl's arm. Her hands fell together and ran over each other, feeling for any small scratch, any tiny damage he might have done them in his passion. And as he sat there, clutching his wrist, he saw the hands run to the far side of the little table, hook themselves over the edge, and, contracting, draw her out of her place. She had no volition of her own, but her hands had. Creeping over the walls, watching obscure and precarious holds on the wainscoting, they dragged the girl from the room. And Ran sat there and sobbed, not so much from the pain in his swelling arm, but in shame for what he had done. They might have been one to him in another, gentler way. His head was bowed, yet suddenly he felt the gaze of those hands. He looked up suddenly to see one of them whisk around the doorpost. It had come back then, to see. Ran rose heavily and took himself and his shame away. Yet he was compelled to stop in the doorway, even as had Bianca's hands. He watched covertly and saw them come into the room dragging the unprotesting idiot girl. They brought her to the long bench where Ran had sat with her. They pushed her onto it, flung themselves to the table, and began rolling and flattening themselves most curiously about. Ran suddenly realized that there was something of his there, and he was comforted a little. They were rejoicing, drinking thirstily, reveling in his tears. Afterwards, for 19 days, the hands made Ran do penance. He knew them as inviolate and unforgiving. They would not show themselves to him, remaining always hidden in Bianca's dress or under the supper table. For those 19 days, Rand's passion and desire grew. More. His love became true love, for only true love knows reverence, and the possession of those hands had become his reason for living, his goal in the life that reason had given him. Ultimately, they forgave him. They kissed him coyly when he was not looking, touched him on the wrist, caught him and held him for one sweet moment. It was at table. A great power surged through him, and he gazed down at the hands, now returned to Bianca's lap. A strong muscle in his jaw twitched and twitched, swelled and fell. Happiness like golden light flooded him. Passion spurred him. Love imprisoned him. Reverence was the gold of the golden light. The room wheeled and whirled about him, and the forces unimaginable flickered through him. Battling with himself, yet lax in the glory of it, Rand sat unmoving, beyond the world. Enslaved and yet possessor of all. Bianca's hands flushed pink, and if ever hands smiled to each other, then they did. He rose abruptly, flinging his chair from him, feeling the strength of his back and shoulders. Bianca's mother, by now beyond surprise, looked at him and away. There was that in his eyes which she did not like, for to fathom it would disturb her, and she wanted no trouble. Rand strode from the room and outdoors to be by himself, that he might learn more of this new thing that had possessed him. It was evening. The crooked, bending skyline drank the buoyancy of the sun, dragged it down, sucking greedily. Rand stood on a knoll, his nostrils flaring, feeling the depth of his lungs. He sucked in the crisp air, and it smelled new to him, as though the sunset shades were truly in it. He knotted the muscles of his thighs and stared at his smooth, solid fists. He raised his hands high over his head and, stretching, sent out such a great shout that the sun sank. He watched it, knowing how great and tall he was, how strong he was, knowing the meaning of longing and belonging. And then he lay down on the clean earth and he wept. When the sky grew cold enough for the moon to follow the sun beyond the hills, and still an hour after that, Rand returned to the house. He struck a light in the room of Bianca's mother, where she slept on a pile of old cloths. Rand sat beside her and let the light wake her. She rolled over to him and moaned, opened her eyes, and shrank from him. "Rand, what do you want?" "Bianca. I want to marry Bianca." Her breath hissed between her gums. "No." It was not a refusal, but astonishment. Rand touched her arm impatiently. Then she laughed. "To marry Bianca? It's late, boy. Go back to bed, and in the morning you'll have forgotten this thing, this dream." "I've not been to bed," he said patiently, but growing angry. "Will you give me Bianca or not?" She sat up and rested her chin on her withered knees. "You're right to ask me, for I'm her mother. Still and all, Rand, you've been good to us, Bianca and me. You are a good boy, but forgive me, lad, but you're something of a fool. Bianca's a monster. I say it, though I am what I am to her. Do what you like, and never a word will I say. You should have known. I'm sorry you asked me, for you have given me the memory of speaking so to you. I don't understand you, but do what you like, boy." It was to have been a glance, but it became a stare, and she saw his face, as she saw his face. He put his hands carefully behind his back, and she knew he would have killed her else. "I'll marry her then," he whispered. She nodded, terrified. "As you like, boy." He blew out the light and left her. Rand worked hard and saved his wage, and made one room beautiful for Bianca and himself. He built a soft chair and a table that was like an altar for Bianca's sacred hands. There was a great bed, and a heavy cloth to hide and soften the walls, and a rug. They were married, though marrying took time. Rand had to go far afield before he could find one who would do what was necessary. The man came far and went again afterwards, so that none knew of it, and Rand and his wife were left alone. The mother spoke for Bianca, and Bianca's hand trembled frighteningly at the touch of the ring, writhed and struggled, and then lay passive, blushing and beautiful. But it was done. Bianca's mother did not protest, for she didn't dare. Rand was happy. And Bianca, well, nobody cared about Bianca. After they were married, Bianca followed Ran and his two brides into the beautiful room. He washed Bianca and used rich lotions. He washed and combed her hair and brushed it many times until it shone, to make it more fit to be with the hands he had married. He never touched the hands, though he gave them soaps and creams and tools with which they could groom themselves. They were pleased. Once one of them ran up to his coat, Once one of them ran up his coat and touched his cheek and made him exultant. He left them and returned to the shop with his heart full of music. He worked harder than ever so that Harding was pleased and let him go home early. He wandered the hours away by the bank of a brook, watching the sun on the face of the chuckling water. A bird came to circle him, flew unafraid through the aura of gladness about him. The delicate tip of a wing brushed his wrist with the touch of the first secret kiss from the hands of Bianca. The singing that filled him was part of the nature of laughing, the running of water, the sound of the wind in the reeds by the edge of the stream. He learned for the hands, and he knew he could go now and clasp them and own them. Instead, he stretched out on the bank and lay smiling, all lost in the sweetness and poignance of waiting, denying desire. He laughed for pure joy in a world without hatred, held in the stainless palms of Bianca's hands. As it grew dark, he went home. All night during that nuptial meal, Bianca's hands twisted about one of his while he ate with the other, and Bianca's mother fed the girl. The fingers twined about each other and about his own, so that three hands seemed to be wrought of one flesh, to become that a thing of lovely weight at his arm's end. When it was quite dark, they went to the beautiful room and lay where he and the hands could watch, through the window, the clean, bright stars swimming up out of the forest. The house and the room were dark and silent. Ran was so happy that he hardly dared to breathe. A hand fluttered up over his hair, down his cheek, and crawled into the hollow of his throat. Its pulsing matched the beat of his heart. He opened his own hands wide and clenched his fingers, as though to catch and hold this moment. Soon, the other hand crept up and joined the first. For perhaps an hour, they lay there, passive with their coolness against Rand's warm neck. He felt them with his throat, each smooth convolution, each firm small expanse. He concentrated, with his mind and his heart on his throat, on each part of the hands that touched him, feeling with all his being first one touch and then another, through the contact, though the contact was there, unmoving. And he knew it would be soon now, soon. As if at a command, he turned on his back and dug his head into the pillow. Staring up at the vague, dark hangings on the wall, he began to realize what it was for, what it was for which he had been working and dreaming so long. He put his head back farther and smiled, waiting. This would be possession, completion. He breathed deeply twice, and the hands began to move. The thumbs crossed over his throat, and the fingertips settled one by one under his ears. For a long moment they lay there, gathering strength. Together then, in perfect harmony, each cooperating with the other, they became rigid, rock hard. Their touch was still light upon him. Still light? No. Now they were passing their rigidity to him, turning it into a contraction. They settled to it slowly, their pressure measured and equal. Ran lay silent. He could not breathe now, and did not want to. His great arms were crossed on his chest, his knotted fists under his armpits, his mind knowing a great peace. Soon now. Wave after wave of engulfing, glorious pain spread and receded. He saw color impossible without light. He arched his back up, up. The hands bore down with all their hidden strength, and Rand's body bent like a bow, resting on feet and shoulders. Up, up! Something burst within him, his lungs, his heart, no matter. It was complete. There was blood on the hands of Bianca's mother when they found her in the morning in the beautiful room, trying to soothe Rand's neck. They took Bianca away, and they buried Rand, but they hanged Bianca's mother because she tried to make them believe Bianca had done it. Bianca, whose hands were quite dead, drooping like brown leaves from her wrists.
little moving around of things here.
Take this off. Well, we're going to let this continue while Noel Sturgeon rearranges the stage a few months ago. But on stage are Nora Jemison, N.K. Jemison, and Samuel R. Delaney, celebrating the life and work of Theodore Sturgeon. And they're going to do a little... we had to rearrange the mics and all that, but I'd like to hear again what they had to say about Sturgeon. We're not going to have time for the full half-hour discussion, but... In fact, we're going to do...
I hope that people in the back can still
see us. Yeah. We don't need to hear the rearranging of furniture. I'm going to jump ahead in time like they do in movies. And there we go. That's Chip.
It's very funny. I always forget the ending of the story. What I remember is just Rand's absolute fascination with the hands, which is just beautifully rendered. And it almost doesn't matter what he wants, them for. It's just, it's just one of those superb presentations of desire itself. And it's always surprising to me when I get to the end. When I get to the end of the story, and remember, oh yeah, that's what he wanted them to distract. He wanted them to kill him. And it's a love and death. It's a quintessential American love and death story.
Huh? She liked the turn of phrase.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but it's just it's a very. I always thought it was just an incredibly impressive performance. And it's just one of those really beautiful, beautiful stories. That's about all I can really say about it as a story.
I will also echo all of that. The sort of consuming passion of the story really, really fascinated me. And just that it's a story about obsession. It's a story about not so much love. I mean, there's no love in this. And the psychologist in me, of course, keeps going straight to, Thanatos and Eros, and I don't want to go all Freudian on you, but, so there's obvious connections there. And I was actually telling someone at the intercession that the thing that struck me about this was that there is so much daring in it. As a new author who's, just kind of starting off her career, one of the things that I kind of have to constantly fight in myself is the urge to tone down everything that I'm doing, to try and kind of hold back and not be, not let my ovaries show, frankly. I have them, I should flash them. Go nuts, to be gender neutral. But that said, one of the things that kind of continually gets me is the fact that I'm always trying to hold back on doing things that are truly daring. And here is probably one of the most daring stories that I've ever read, written when my grandmother was a spot on the wall. So, it's powerful, it's truly daring. I wish that I had this kind of skill. I'm not surprised that it took so long to get it published. But I also understand why it got so many accolades once it did.
It's interesting about this story. He is a story about obsession, I think you're right. He himself claimed to be obsessed by it. In other words, the way he described it is that he had to write it and then he couldn't do anything else until he wrote this story, and it kind of took him over when he wrote it. He was very proud of it because it is an example of something he tried to do called metered prose, which there's a couple of sections in the story that are written to a kind of poetic meter, and he didn't want that to be obvious, but he wanted it to sort of give a feeling and you hear it when it's read. I've learned a lot listening to these stories that I didn't really know about when my father's book. But this story is a horror story, really.
Yes.
And so it's not really a science. It's an example of, he wrote a lot of different kinds of stories. He had a freedom that I don't think new writers have now because there's so many niches. He wrote horror, he wrote this comedic language, he wrote science fiction, he wrote things that
weren't science fiction, they just had a little bit of science fiction, and Clinton would be better at it. And I just wanted to say also that this was a very famous story, and a lot of science fiction writers read it and loved it. But they didn't really think about what it was about, I don't think. There's a way in which it has a meaning now, today. You hear, you know, the awful way that the mentally disabled girl is described in the story, and just the subject matter. When Jim Gunn, who's a science fiction writer, just a little bit younger than Ted, read this story at Kansas, he said, oh, I want to read Young Sands, I want to read it. It's one of my favorite stories. And then he read the story, and I watched him, and I could see that he was sitting in public, and I could see him realizing that this was a story about a sexual perversion of a very deep kind. And when he was done, he put the microphone down, and he said, my God, I never really realized how awful this story is.
I will argue just a little bit. I think everything you say is correct, but I think it is a story about love. I think it is a story about love. Look at all the things that he learns in the relationship. He learns he cannot do. He can't just grab those hands. He has to be gentle. He has to wait. You know, and the reason he has to wait is because he loves them. He's obsessed with them. But you can love what you're obsessed with, and there's a tension between the two of them. And the tension is, you know, it's just that he must be gentle with them. He can be brutal with them. If he wants to get what he dreams of getting, he's got to be
coaxing,
gentle, kind, and patient, incredibly patient. And he learns all that. He learns it very quickly. And that's the one thing that makes it kind of a fantasy. He learns lessons that it takes some of us 10 years to learn, in 2 or 3 days. But the assumption is, because the love is so strong, that's why he learns it so quickly. The 19 days in which the hands, withhold themselves from it. That's what the story is about. And that's where I think Sturgeon says that that's how we know that it's pure love, because he can live quietly without the hands because he knows they're there. No, he doesn't have to. He doesn't have to be excited by them visually. He doesn't have to be excited by them tactily. Just the knowledge that they are there. Is what makes. I recognize real love in this story. It's scary because the love is an incredibly self-destructive love. It results in his death, and that's what he wants. Mm-hmm. And he wants them, and they are willing, and because she has no, perhaps moral. What's the word? What would be the word? Moral awareness. She's
no moral standing.
Yes, right. She's no willing. Sense. Yes, she's willing. The hands are willing to give him what he wants. Mm-hmm. Why not? She gets what she wants, which is to say, the hands want to be venerated and worshipped, mm-hmm. and which is what he gives them the worship and the reticence. That so we know the worship is true worship, and they repay him with what he wants.
And I hadn't thought about the image at the end. I had not thought about. I'm coming around to your opinion on it. I'm waffling because there's some gender issues in this story.
Sure. No. Yeah.
I really think. Yeah, gender issues I think need to be parsed in order to determine whether
Absolutely.
This is love or use.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a mutual use. And,
yeah.
and you, the very end, the very final image, the fact that the hands give him what he wants.
Mm-hmm.
He's given them what they want. They give him what he wants. They both respect each other enough to do that. And the hands mourn.
Yes.
That, I think you're right.
Okay.
The hands.
Okay, well, that brings out... Now, that was the end of the discussion about Bianca's hands at that moment. I mean, there were more to the proceedings, including the story, I'm ashamed to say, the title of which I don't recall, and there are very few Sturgeon titles I don't recall, but Chip purposely chose a not obvious one that spoke to him in some way. But that was, again, Samuel R. Delaney, Noel Sturgeon, and N.K. Jemisin discussing the story that you heard Nora, that's N.K. Jemisin, reading Bianca's hands. And a reminder that the complete stories of Theodore Sturgeon are available. Paul Williams put these together before he had horrific, God, everything's so depressing tonight, horrific brain problems occurred to him, so that nowadays he's alive but in a vegetative state. But with Noel, he put together the complete stories of Theodore Sturgeon, and that's, I think, 14 volumes, all hardcover, very, very, very collectible. And to find out more, well, go to the bookseller nearest you, whether it's a brick-and-mortar bookstore or a online bookstore, and inquire further. This is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifico Radio at 99.5 FM. We have 5 minutes left before it is time for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister, coming your way over these same airwaves. But if you would like to call up and discuss what you have heard this morning, the number is 212-209-2900. Again, 212-209-2900. And pardon me while I look before I take calls. And do call in. I see one call's coming in. Let's get a couple more. Let me just see. I said that we're going to be busy on the air for the next few weeks. Let's see, there's tonight, next week, Stand Up Academy with Simon Lokely is going to be next Monday. Be sure to check that out. Next Tuesday, I'm going to be recording the next segment of Altered Fluid. Yes, I will probably have a recorded event next week on the show. The week after that, Susan and Clay Griffith will be here live. Over the next few weeks, Chris Claremont, Louise Simonson, Danny Fingeroth is November 10th. And I want to get Rick Bowes back to take the phone calls we didn't have time to do on September 11th for There's a Hole in the City. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Yeah. Hi, Jim.
Yeah.
Yeah. Quick peripheral question. How is Sam Delaney doing, and what is his latest work, if he's been writing recently?
He's doing well. I've seen him a few times recently, after a while of sort of not being around. I believe he has a new, believe it or not, science fiction book coming out within the next few months.
Wow.
I believe.
I'm a fan of his, so that's good news.
To say that I'm a fan of his is an understatement.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, I understand. Is he in his 70s now? Or?
He is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you for that.
Thank you. We got to get Chip back here live. Health permitting, he'll do it. But, you know, he's still teaching at Temple University, so it's not easy for him to always be here.
Oh, Sam is?
Yeah.
Oh,
Chip.
Great.
Chip. Beautiful. Yeah, very few people call him Sam. I've only heard one person do that to his face and really
Chip
get him...
Chip is his name.
Chip Delaney.
Chip Delaney.
It's either Samuel R. Delaney or Chip Delaney.
Okay. There you go. Something I learned.
There you go.
Okay. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye. I should mention, I met Chip when I came here at WBAI in 1967 when he was working on The Star Pit. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, Robert. Your third call.
Yeah, well, let me tell you something. I have a personal reason why I'm glad you played that story. Have you ever been in a session? And
we have approximately 2 minutes.
Yeah, no. Have you ever been in a session where you heard a story and you said, this mood can never be gotten again. This is too good. I have to tell you very quickly, I heard this story about 35 years ago in an underground grotto outside of Lexington, Louisville, Kentucky, called Carter's Cave in a Halloween ghost story session. And they were reading, originals. Somebody did Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, The Cats of Ulthar, the story about the little boy who could make people disappear into cornfields, the one about Anthony.
It's a Good Life by Jerome Bixby.
Yes. And they and somebody read this one. And I said, nobody. The mood, for 2 days, I didn't shake anybody's hand.
Right.
And when you played this tonight, I said, I wonder if this can beat it. And it tied. I don't think
Nora is a good reader. I'd never heard her reading anybody else's work, but she did a great job, and I loved that conversation which ensued.
Yes.
Okay, wait, 1 minute.
Okay.
I mean, I'm off in 1 minute.
Okay, well then, take another call.
Okay, thanks. But actually, I don't have time to take another call, because before I go off, I get to say things like, you've been listening to Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. See, these things take time. And if you'd like to write me, please do so. Jim, J-I-M, at ourwolf.com, H-O-U-R-W-O-L-F.com. If you want to be on my mailing list for the reading series I produce, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, mention that, and I will put you on the mailing list. And, well, again, thank you all for listening. I'd like to thank my anonymous guest for being here. And stay tuned, as mentioned, for Burn Baby Burn Clappers. I almost said Burn Baby Burn Lister with Clapper, but that would have been the wrong way around. Just stay tuned. And everybody, try to sustain yourself through the week. Good morning.
Wolfgang. When I'm in New York, I always have my radio tuned to 99.5 FM WBAI. When I return home to Berlin in Germany, I listen on the web at wbai.org. Moin moin, ich heiße Wolfgang. Wenn ich in New York bin, dann höre ich Radio auf 99,5 WBAI. Aber wenn ich nach Hause gehe, auch in Deutschland, höre ich wbai.org im Internet.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover.
This is Saul Williams.
And this is Michael Frind from Spearhead.
And this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
This is Reverend Jesse Jackson of the Rainbow Push Coalition. Please call and support WBAI, non-commercial, peace and justice radio in New York.
People moving out, people moving in. Why? Because of the color of the skin.
Run, 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 put your show can't hide.
Ukama uxoxela amaxoxo ngamaqadi aziqeketha kuze kuse. Hi, my name is Duduzo Kambili, and I always have my radio tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI. And when I go home to South Africa to visit my family, I listen on the web at WBAI. Igama lami ngingos Duduzo Kambili. Njalo nje ngihlale ngilalela iBAI. Ngihlala khona, ngilala khona, ngidla khona. Ngoba phela lesi isiteshini sodu.
Over men and horses, hoops and carts, is lostly through a hotbed of real fire. In this way, Mr. K will change the world. Crazy Mr. K performs his feat on Saturday at Bishop's Gate. The Hendersons will dance and sing as Mr. K flies through the ring. Don't be late. Mrs. K and H assure the public their production will be second to none. And of course, Henry the Horse dances a winner is out. Rock your feet and dance. Crowd of people full of enjoyment. Rock your feet and dance. You don't be coffee bringing out the place. Rocky beat and dance.
99 Cinco.
Rocky beat and dance.
99 Cinco list alive right here. 2 minutes after 3 o'clock, you're in tune to radio station WBAI 99 Cinco. WBAI.org.
When Mr. K performs his tricks with all the sound. Mr. H will demonstrate in Somerset he'll undertake on solid ground. Having been some days in preparation, a splendid time is guaranteed for all. And tonight Mr. Kite is stopping the bill.
And you're in tune to radio station WBAI 99.5 FM, WBAI.org, right here at 212-209-2900. 15 minutes after 3 o'clock, broken hearted about the execution of Troy Davis at 11:08 p.m. last night, Eastern Standard Time.
All of them do.
State murders another citizen based upon a whole lot of doubt, meaning no evidence.
All of them do.
Sure is dedicated to Troy and his family right here at 99 Cinco WBAI. So sad, so sad. Listen.
Evolve a man as I unravel the deepness. Examine the evidence, decipher the secrets. Come give me the realness. Time to let go the weakness. Dangerous systems, innocent victims. Vote for peace, come back with John, don't the killing. Call when we come in, I go roam in your defend. Yes, me I defend, I may not apprehend. Time to open up, let go and venture. Not defend our love with a hidden agenda. For soul takes time, so never surrender. Only you can defend ya. Tired of the eyes that suffer with blinkers. East to the far eye and you the thinkers. Belief is golden and love is sacred. And war is naked.
Now you tell me how the victims can sleep at night knowing that they murdered an innocent man known as Troy Davis. 22 years.
All of them are doing. All of them are trying.
22 years.
Blessed by the Most High.
So sad.
Time to open up, let go, stop doubting. Time to keep a focus. Beware of the bogus. For hate is a tool and passed by the fool. For love will conquer, stand up on a rule. Know your roots and the truths and rights will come. Never give up, don't run. Na 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 sweet flex.
Cinco, like I said before, they treat democracy in imperialist America like how they treat weed, you know? 11:08 sharp Eastern Standard Time, the murderous racist state of Georgia does what, as American as American apple pie, executed an innocent man. The way I look at it, all them DNA cases that got off, those are like murdered people. Use that same logic on the Troy Davis case. And you say to yourself, how can the victims, family, sleep at night knowing this? Or they just don't give a damn.
All of them are trying. Would them can't stop high. Blessed by the Most High.
Now you know why we had to call the show Burn Baby Burn. Seen? Clap us, because we mean it. With no apology, the burning of the American flag. With no apology. Straight up. Georgian situation gives you another example why we had to call the show Burn Baby Burn. Baba Vakin, what you say?
Banha da ouro, com uma tinta tão forte que corta o seu corpo. da sombra da morte me torne mais forte. Guia-me pelo vale da sombra da morte me torne mais forte. Disso que eu preciso, ó Jah. Jah, Jah, poderoso de Rastafari, me guia, ai, ai, poderoso de Rastafari. Jah, Jah, poderoso de Rastafari, me guia, ai, ai, poderoso de Rastafari. Jah, todo poderoso guia-me, me dê sabedoria pra que eu possa prosseguir na batalha da vida, firme e forte até o fim. Caminho da salvação eterna, então eu vou seguir, Senhor. Todo poderoso, dai-me força, livrai-nos do mal, da forca, não deixe o sangue ruim da Babilônia me oprimir, nem me denegrir, me maldizer, me destruir. Guia-me pelo vale da sombra da morte, me torne mais forte. Guia-me pelo vale da sombra da morte, me torne mais forte. Guia-me pelo vale da sombra da morte, me torne mais forte. Watch out! Jah, Jah, poderoso de Rastafari, me guia, ai, ai, poderoso de Rastafari. Jah, Jah, poderoso de Rastafari, me
Thank you very much, Augustus. Pablo right here with Jamala, Bugsy on bass, Noel Alfonso on drums, Ernest Ranglin's son on keyboards, and the leader of the group, Cleon Douglas, who lives up in Vermont. Dedicating this to Troy Davis's family, who witnessed the racist state of imperialist America in Georgia execute an innocent man based upon absolutely nothing. Bullet shells prove absolutely nothing, because if I stood there and murdered somebody and the shells are still there, you standing over on the other street, you come over and stand by the shells, and then they say you murdered the cat that I murdered. How can the police victim's family sleep at night? Sleep at night. Troy Davis, we'll miss you.
Even when there's no one sitting there, but a chair is not a house, and a house. To hold you tight and no one there you can kiss goodnight. Oh. A room is still a room, even when there's nothing there but gloom. But a room is not a house, and a house is not a home when the two of us are far. Now and then I call your name, and suddenly your face appears, but it's just a crazy game. When it ends, it ends. Pretty little darling, have a heart. And don't let one mistake keep us apart. I'm not meant to live alone. Turn this heart. Saying that you're still in love with me. Yeah. I'm not meant to live alone. Turn this house into a home where I climb the stairs and turn the key. Oh, please be there. Still in love. I said, still in love. Still. With you.
you're gonna be in love with me. I want you and need you to be, yeah, still in love with me. Say you're gonna be in love with me. It's driving me crazy to think that my baby couldn't be still in love with me. Are you gonna be, say you're gonna be, are you gonna be, say you're gonna be, are you gonna be, say you're gonna be? Well, 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 still in love, so in love, still in love.
And if you're just waking up, 11:08 last night, the racist imperialist state executed another citizen of the world, Troy Davis, based upon absolutely no evidence. Now you know why we had to call the show Burn, Baby Burn. 99 Sinker listed right here on a Thursday. Thank you very much, Luther Vandross. Before that, the genius Augustus Pablo. 212-209-2900. You tell me how the policeman's family can sleep at night knowing that the imperialist state, the racist imperialist state, has killed another innocent human on the planet Earth. Just like in how they disdain Ahmadinejad land and say, we're not like them. You're right, you're just worse.
I'm living while I'm living, to the Father I will pray. Only Him know how we get through every day. Only I can the price, arm and leg we have to pay. While our leaders play, all I see, people are going to rob, all a bribe. Thief never love, you see, thief. To the poor, may God help your soul. What is to stop the youth from get out of control?
Dedicating this to Joel Chin's mother, Juliet Chin. Her son gave Lister this record when it wasn't even mixed to play a 99 single, WBAI Burn Baby Burn. Executed in Jamaica on a Thursday about 10:05, 10:15, Kingston time. Kill some J.A. Close range, 3 bullets in the head, y'all. Dead. Joel Chin, we'll miss you.
I say, who can afford to run? We'll run. But what about those who can't? They will have to stay. Opportunity, a scarce, scarce commodity. In these times, I say, when mama spend her last and send you go class, never you ever play. It's a competitive.
There is no democracy under occupation. There is no democracy under capitalism. There is no justice under capitalism. Troy Davis proved that. Listen to lyrics.
Could go on and on, the fool has never been told.
This is the IRA from J.A. From Belfast to kill some J.A. Chuck Yaila.
I'm living while I'm living, to the Father I will pray. Only Him know how we get through every day. All the hike and the price, arm and leg we have to pay. While our leaders play, all I see, people are ripping and rob, all a bribe, all thief, never love, you see, thief, with long back. To the poor, may God help your soul. What is to stop the youth from get out of control? Full up our education, yet no all, no payroll. The clothes on their back of countless aisle. Could go on and on, the fool has never been told. Could go on and on, the fool has never been told. Could go on and on, the fool has never been told. Could go on and on, the fool has never been told. Could go on and on.
marching out the old towards the new century, armed with the new technology. We're getting more and more productivity. Some say things looking up for prosperity. But if everyone gon' get a share this time, well, mentality must get left behind. We want the shorter working day, give it the shorter working week. Longer holiday, we need peace and fear. More time for leisure, more time for pleasure, more time for edification, more time for recreation, more time for contemplate, more time for ruminate, more time. We need more time, give it more time. A full time them abolish unemployment and revolutionize labor deployment. A full time them banish overtime. Make everybody get a work this time. We need a higher quality of liberty. We need it now and for everybody. We need the shorter working year. Give it the shorter working life. More time for the husband, more time for the wife. More time for the children, more time for we friend, and more time for meditate, more time for create, more time for living, more time for life, more time. We need more time, give it more time. We're getting more and more productivity. Some say things looking up for prosperity. But if everyone gon' get a share this time, well, mentality must get left behind. We want the shorter working day, give it the shorter working week. Longer holiday, we need peace and fear. More time for leisure, more time for pleasure, more time for edification, more time for recreation, more time for contemplate, more time for ruminate, more time. We need more time, give it more time. A full time them abolish unemployment and revolutionize labor deployment. A full time them punish overtime. Make everybody get a work this time. We need a higher quality of liberty. We need it now and for everybody. We want the shorter working year. Give it the shorter working life. More time for the husband. More time for the wife. More time for the children. More time for a friend. And more time for meditate. More time for create. More time for living. More time for life. More time. We need more time. Give it more time.
Jump on Brown Mike, Brigadier Jerry, man called Dookie, Teeny, Judd Nooks, and one called Charles the Wanted, but a man called Ringo, you know? Do it! Everybody get ready. Come do Gemini X steady. Cause it's a Baba Moon time. Tingle fall start in the Willow Pazan. Isis and come to you all at a part. You know? Do it! Right start. You know? Yeah. Tell them. Tell me some boom, chaka laka laka, boom 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 boom. 20, Rocky, ayo. Chaka boom, chaka laka laka, boom 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 boom, ayo. Tell him. Me name a woman and say I'm just reached 20. Me walking down the street, me my two man a see. One short and black, one fat and Irie. He asks me what me name, me tell him woman and see. He asks me what me live, me tell him uptown city. He asks me what me bum, me tell him. He asks me where me where me tell him Terry can see. He asks me where me where me tell him Silver Jubilee. He asks me who me pray me tell him God Almighty. Come in here, mama Nancy. And let me tell you something coming from the uptown city. And let me tell you say no boy can't trick me. Because me physical fit and me a chemist in a need. Me jump over the precipice not falling a hit. Me physical fit. But a mama Nancy she a chemist in a this. Ayah.
99 Cent Calista Live, right on the radar, right here where you belong. Burn, baby, burn style. Who plays more women in reggae than Lista? Yo, listen them tune ya. Listen them tune ya.
It's time to rock steady.
Tommy Cowan and the gang.
It's Baba Boom time. Don't lose the beat now. Just dip your head now. It's Festival 5 this year. You hear the people sing, boom, boom. Ba, ba, boom, boom. Boom, boom, festival, boom, boom. Ba, ba, boom, boom. Boom, boom, festival, boom, boom. Ba, ba, boom, boom. Boom, boom, festival, boom.
Sink or burn, baby burn. Back in the days, yeah. The Jamaicans with Tommy Cowan and the gang. Yeah, yeah. Sounds we used to call in the ghetto. Pum Pum Festival. Baba Boom. Licky back from the top, mister. Hear them tune, yeah. Up there, Selassie, straight to your head, hear them tune ya.
Children sing, boom, boom,
ba, ba, boom, 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 festival,
ba, ba, boom.
99 Sinker, 212-209-2900, so we do it. So we do it. Brooklyn, Brooklyn, so we do it. 212-209-2900. Now you know why we had to call the show. Burn, baby, burn. burn the American flag to ashes before 5 o'clock comes in. We'll kick it with Al Jazeera live right here at 99.5 WBAI. List Alive. Sister Nancy, kick it. So obvious that Troy Davis did not kill the pig. This reminds you of the Mumia Abu Jamal case in Philadelphia. Proves that these imperialists are pigs. Thank you very much, Nancy, right here at 54 minutes after the hour at 3 o'clock. We're going to rock it with some ska right here, right up until 4 o'clock. 2122 9 2900 1108.